Hello, I'm Ben Steiner alongside Alex Gongerud-Sik, and welcome to the Between the Steaks podcast, where we are going to discuss Canada's 4-1 loss to the United States tonight. Alex, what are your thoughts?
I think right off the bat, it was a very mixed performance. I think there was a lot of negative things that could be derived from this, and understandably so, as we have seen so far. But I think at the same time, there is a lot of certain good things, and also, you know, just things to derive as well from this that we will do over the coming days, and I think it'll be good just to kind of dissect that.
So, coming off the last game, there was such a big fanfare and big awakening in Canadian soccer, and everyone was like, oh my god, we beat the US, what a big thing. Does this kill all that?
I think, in a sense, it's like the timing really kills us. Someone I saw on Twitter did make a mention, like, yeah, if the Canada and U.S. results reversed, it would look a lot better for Canada because, you know, they would have, oh, they came back to beat the U.S., whereas now there was that expectation that was fairly or unfairly built up from the other game. So I think now there's going to be a lot of, but we beat the U.S. at home. What happened? How did we get so outplayed? Well, I mean, that comes down to plenty of factors that we will break down, but at the same time, it was an influence on the expectations of people.
So you speak about these factors that we're going to break down. What are these factors? Maybe two or three that we'll talk about here on the Between the Sticks podcast.
Well, I think one thing that John Herdman is going to suffer immensely from is tactics. Tactics, tactics. Tactics were a big thing in the first leg. People acknowledge John Herdman got it right. And often so far in his tenure, that hasn't been a phrase that has been on the lips of many. But I think now into this game, they seem to be putting this loss to tactics, and I'm going to say right now, I personally think that is rather unfair. I mean, John Herdman, yes, to criticize him, he made a mistake by putting Alphonso Davies at left back, not necessarily because the idea of Alphonso Davies at left back was bad, but I think removing Kamal Miller and Derek Cornelius from the starting 11 really killed it. People would be like, well, Herdman himself said it was for fitness reasons. I think it doesn't matter. You saw Daniil Henry. If you're going to talk fitness reasons, that guy's played even further away since Cornelius, and you could just tell he was off the coup. He got injured. Like, it was just not a good, what you'd call a banner performance from Henry. So I think on that hand, I think you really suffered, especially one thing as a coach, people say you keep a clean sheet. If it isn't broken, you don't fix it. And I think that really just set the tone, because Canada, surprisingly, like the first kickoff, they look sharp. You're like, okay, Canada's here to play. What happens? 90 seconds in, Davies makes a giveaway at the fullback. He's the last man. They don't concede, but they give up a corner, and then from there, the U.S. score off a nice flick, and then they're chasing the game. So I think personnel-wise, that defense really killed them, because when you concede a goal that early, your game plan goes out the window. And even despite that, Canada had a good hold of their midfield game plan for the most part, but that goal really made them chase more than they wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, when you let a goal in so early, that can change the total plan, total mentality of your players, your coaches, everything around the team and organization. It changes when you let a goal in early. It's never the plan. But another thing on the Alphonso Davies front is he's played so well for Bayern Munich recently. We see him against Borussia Dortmund a couple weeks ago, and he was fantastic. Why play him at left back in a position he hasn't really played?
I think at the same time, the Bayern Munich and Canada parallel, we have to consider for Bayern Munich, he's been training as a fullback since August, since July, because Niko Kovac has long stated that he did see, at least for now, a role for Davies at left back. So in that sense, it was no surprise. But then again, you look at that squad, he is sheltered by some quality defenders, some quality midfielders, and some just overall system that suits, and the Bayern's so much more dominant than their opponent, so they can get away with that. And even then, he was great, but then again, you saw it in today's game. He was just I think probably the biggest thing that killed him was the style of the game. So I think for Herdman, if he were playing a Costa Rica, who is a good opponent, but they love to sit back, Davies would have been excellent. But I think against the U.S., who are as deadly as they are in transition, it really hurt them. And I think that's why the move should be, I guess, attacked. Not that's too harsh of a word. I'm criticized but it's mostly because of that. Because the move itself was sound in principle, but against this U.S. team, it was inevitable that this could happen.
I mean, in the last Canada-USA game on October 15th, exactly 1 month ago, we saw Canada's wonderful transition. It was fast. It was clean. It was magnificent. I was watching that game in Vancouver. Unfortunately, I couldn't be there. And I was blown away by Alphonso Davies, Lucas Cavallini, literally everybody on that field was fantastic in transition, and that just wasn't there tonight. What was missing, in your opinion?
I think one thing that did kill Canada was they were unable to jumpstart their attack from the back. And I think last game, they were surprisingly clean in their distribution from the back. I mean, Milan Borjan, he's, as a goalkeeper, I say if you were to put someone like Max Crepo in, whose distribution is at an elite level, you would change that. But Milan was, he was good in the first game with his distribution and the center backs. Everyone found a way to get it from back to front today. Too often I saw giveaways on the second goal. Borjan kicked it to another team. They scored on that ensuing transition play. So just that distribution. Because Canada, when they did generate turnovers, because their midfield, again, they swarmed effectively in moments and it created chances. But I think too often, the last game, when they weren't getting those moments, they were able to survive by building out of the back, and today that wasn't there. So I think if you're going to look at what changed was that ability in transition. Also, at the same time, the U.S., last time, they stubbornly, probably because Michael Bradley was on the pitch, forced their way through the midfield. They got the ball to Bradley. He moved it out. Yeah, he had a 96 pass percentage, but often he was forced to make lateral passes because Canada swarmed him. Today, what did the U.S. do? They smartly, partly because Bradley wasn't on the field, but also you'd have to give Berhalter credit for recognizing this, they bypassed the midfield. What happens when you bypass the Canadian midfield? You avoid having guys like Kay, Piet, Arfield swarm you, and that really helped nullify the Canadian transition game.
Do you think the Canadians' mentality coming into this game was affected by some of the key absences that the U.S. had, like Pulisic? He wasn't on the pitch in Orlando, or really any of the other players who weren't there for the U.S.? Did that affect Canada's mentality and maybe their fight and just overall mentality, yes, going into this game? Personally, I think it probably did. You see that Pulisic isn't there. Maybe John Brooks and his other defender are the biggest names on that team coming in. And you're Alphonso Davies thinking, well, shit, I have some experience here. I have been taking on defenders in the Bundesliga. I know how to get through these guys. And then maybe that cockiness just gets too much. Is that something that would go through your mind as well? Or do you think these are athletes that are trained for that?
I think on one hand, the only reason I would consider is if Herdman set up his side with that in mind. And it is very entirely possible that he did, because he did come out a lot more aggressive than anyone, especially myself. I thought he was going to come out. He did come out with the 4-4-2. I wasn't surprised by the formation, but I was surprised about how aggressive, like, Davies at left back, and you saw right away they played a high line, like they were going for it, and that's where it's he did in a way over prepare for that, whereas I don't think the players were too overwhelmed by the idea of the U.S. being undermanned on paper. But I think honestly what the U.S. did do is tactically, I'll give it to Berhalter, I didn't think he would be able to adjust to this level. He has shown to be rather stubborn, but he did show a level of adjustment that really changed the game. And I think that plays as much of a role as the aforementioned factors. So I think if I were to look at it, it came down to a combination of Canada coming out a lot more aggressive than I thought they would. And it was the U.S. being a lot more aggressive than I thought they were. And in that sense, that benefited the U.S. Because for Canada, what helped last game is that the U.S. were so passive and they were so aggressive. But at the same time, they kept a low block, they kept defensive stability, whereas in this game, they came out aggressive, they came out with a high line, and against a team that matches your aggression, it can blow up, and that's exactly what happened.
And if we take a look at where Canada stands in World Cup qualifying contention right now, where is the Canadian national team, and what has to happen for them to make the hexagonal?
Well, I think now it's just, as has been this whole cycle, it's math, calculators, equations, headaches, all that, because it was very clear, it was set out at this game, a victory puts the destiny in Canada's hand. They would win the group, they would ensure themselves more competitive games, and not only competitive games, games that do not, that since they are competitive, they ensure they do not lose points. So since they're not losing points, boom, those are the kind of gains they need, especially for FIFA points. And at the same time, they're getting points for winning. So in this case, okay, a draw, okay, you don't win as many points, but you get to where you need to be. So I think this loss probably is the worst case scenario, because now it leaves, because a win would have put El Salvador in the dust. Now El Salvador, you have to hope for a loss against Bermuda. Hey, it happened, but like, are you really going to be sitting there relying on a loss like that? So it's just, it's math, it's watching other games. Like, hey, Cuba could draw and Canada could still go through. I'm not going to say that isn't out of the realm of possibility yet, but now it's just like they had a chance to control their destiny, and now that's gone.
So in your post-game report, you highlighted that we have to keep an eye on the U.S.-Cuba game. What's the result that the Canadian men's national team will be looking for there?
I think, obviously, you want a Cuban victory. But let's be real with ourselves. Cuba hasn't scored yet. They came close against Canada at home. So I think, but what I have highlighted as something to watch out for, the U.S., since 2014, because due to the Gold Cup being at home, and qualifiers, they don't play many games away. For example, today, they played their 15th game at home. Canada, I think this year, total played 8 or 9 games everywhere. So that they play a lot at home. The U.S. are used to it. They're comfortable at home. They have that sense of, they know what they're doing. What happens when they go on the road? Well, they lose games like they lost to Canada. And that was pretty much their first away game all year. So
Even in Toronto, it's basically home for them. I mean, you're just across the lake from the United States, and so I don't even really know if that counts as an away game.
Yeah, so I mean, that was their first away game all year. Heck, that's crazy to even fathom my mind. I just realized.
Should Canada start hosting more games and just playing more games in general for the Canadian national team?
I mean, they should, but I'll get to that later. But I think to add to my original point, I think the U.S., they're not battle-tested on the road. It showed in the Canada game. They were uncomfortable. Even though they had better players, it really cost them. So I think if they, you're going to see in the Cuba, I mean, personally, I look at the U.S. pedigree, I look at Cuba, I expect to win. Same with Canada. Then again, the Cuban pitch, it's dismal. It's CONCACAF at best. I mean, the Orlando pitch isn't any better, but that's another story for another day.
It is an MLS stadium, so it has to be up to a certain degree of...
Yeah, it was... The pitch was great. The weather was another story, but that's CONCACAF for you. You can't control that. But the Cuba pitch was dismal. It was a beautiful day when Canada played there. But you saw there was divots in the ground. They couldn't pass the ball. They weren't even using top-level balls. Like you kicked it. It sounded like you were playing U7 in the park, and it was just a concussion ball. So I think the U.S. are going to get tested a lot more than they like. And as they've shown over the year with the Trinidad and Tobago disaster, with those kind of games, There's some crazy stat out there. They haven't won more than 2 games on the road since 2014. That's 5 years. Like, Cuba's...
Well, they don't play on the road that often as well, as you mentioned. So they don't really have the chance to win two games on the road. Because you said they're playing their first game on the road in October. So you have November, December, and that's it.
That's it.
You have 2 months to win 2 games on the road. Maybe you have 2 FIFA windows, I guess. That's not many chances, and so you say they've only won 2 games on the road since 2015, but how many games have they really played on the road since then? That's the question to ask.
Well, exactly, because I mean, they do schedule a lot of friendlies, so which is good for their program. I wish Canada did more of that, and hopefully they will soon. But even then, it's rare they go on the road. Last year, okay, they went to England to play Wayne Rooney's testimonial match. Okay, that makes sense, because Wayne Rooney was playing in MLS. But for other games, like, you look at all their friendlies. Oh wow, they play Chile, they play Italy, all these great teams. It's 95% of the time in the U.S. And yeah, it's great.
That's where the money is. It's in the U.S. And that you bring superstars over on the national teams, especially from Europe and maybe even Africa and South America, of course. You're going to bring in money. You're going to fill NFL stadiums, and so that's why they do it. And they have their way with the U.S. sporting atmosphere that they can do it, whereas Canada soccer doesn't really have that weight when it comes to big venues around the country.
Yeah, well, I think it's part of a whole nother problem. I think it's great. You want to make money. You play high-level caliber teams, but you have to remember, this is CONCACAF. CONCACAF road games are everything. Canada's attested to it. They have moments where they beat top teams at home. They go on the roads to St. Kitts and Nevis, and it's a struggle. They win 1-0. They shouldn't be, but that's CONCACAF. You need to test yourself on the road against teams in Europe, in South America, in CONCACAF, and I think that... I'm not saying the U.S. is going to choke against Cuba, but if it happened, I'm not going to be sitting there like, wow, I'm surprised. It would be more obvious than you think.
Especially now in this day and age where all the pitches you're playing on, especially from a young age, we can look at players that are in academies when they're 7 years old or even just organized soccer. You're no longer seeing the guy who played on the gravel pitch. They're not on the national team anymore. You're seeing guys who've been playing on plastic since they were 7 years old. You're seeing guys who played on perfect community pitches. I know both of us playing in Vancouver when we were younger. When did we play on grass? Maybe never.
Oh, Canado, baby. But that's a shout out to my high school boys.
If it was, it wasn't very good grass. I mean, North Shore, that's where a lot of games were. That was gravel or all weather field, as they like to call it, or plastic at best, and maybe even, I don't know whether you can call some of the garbage that they had out there plastic. It might have literally been garbage. One thing I do want to get to here is every game you give each player that played a rating. So we're going to go through the whole team and the rating you gave, and you're going to explain to me and our listeners why you gave them that ranking. So we'll start at the back with Milan Borjan. You gave him a 5 out of 10. Why is that?
I think, well, you also have to remember my scale here. It's 5. 5 and less is more or less disappointing. Well, less than 5. 5 is average. 6 is good. 7 to 10, they really stood out. So I think I gave Borjan a 5. He was average. I think he was unlucky that the first goal was right in his face. I'm not expecting to save that. Same thing, a lot of set pieces. But for me, goalkeepers have to command the area on the set piece. And while I think the team on its own was abysmal at defending set pieces, your goalkeeper does play a big role in that. So in that sense, that's why it's average. Okay, he could have done more, but okay, it is what it is. But in terms of him, his distribution, again, was just lacking tonight. And it doesn't hurt Canada all the time, but in a game like today, it really harmed them, especially when they're hemmed in the back.
And with our next player, who is Alphonso Davies, he and Borjan had a bit of a mix-up that led to a free kick from about 6 yards out. What happened there? How do they fix that? Like, what went wrong in that play?
Well, yeah. That was just probably a rookie mistake. It is a rule, the kind of rule you know, but you don't realize it until you do it, and you're like, oh, okay, I made a big gaffe. And that's probably what Davies is. He probably knows the rule. He's probably like, oh, what the heck was I thinking? But in a game, sometimes your brain leaves you. It happens. As for his overall performance, I gave him a 6. I thought he was better than average. His defensive performance in the first half, especially on the first goal, left a lot to be desired. He was stretched out at times. But I really think he did add a lot to the game offensively. All the 90 minutes, it's just defensively, especially in that first half, it really hurt Canada. And while they solidified the ship in the second half, it was too little too late. So I think he gets a 6 basically because he was out of position, not relative to what he can do, just relative to what the game offered.
And Steven Vittorio was your next highest rank on the defense with a 5.5 rating. What do you think of him and why the 5.5?
I think he started poorly. He was out to lunch on a couple of those set-piece goals early in the first half. His awareness wasn't there. He didn't show the veteran poise he has, but I give credit. It was a rough performance. He picked it up, especially when his, I guess we'll say, more regular partner, Cornelius, he's played with them lately, came in. They showed a good understanding. Vittorio ended up picking up a goal. Yeah, it wasn't a great performance. That's why the 5.5. I think he did eventually in the second half make amends in a sense, and it wasn't as disastrous as I originally thought.
So his starting partner, Daniil Henry, of course, he is used to Derek Cornelius next to him, but both of them are used to Derek Cornelius next to them. It's not usually Vittorio and Henry. For the Whitecaps, it's Cornelius and Henry, and for Canada, it's Vittorio and Cornelius. So it was a total change-up, a total mishmash. You gave Daniil Henry a pretty terrible 4. Why is that?
Daniil Henry's an interesting defender. Having watched him at the Whitecaps, you see his obvious attributes. Obviously, if you're
gonna, he's definitely got a temper.
You see his attributes. You can see what he brings to a game. He's a commanding presence. He's good with the ball at his feet. He tackles well. He's just one of those players. He's got all the tools. The only thing with Henry, sometimes that toolbox isn't there. He brings great leadership, and I can see why Herdman would put him in that way. But you can just tell in a game like this, he's tactically, he's not always disciplined. He can stray. He gets a bit rash, and it's kind of at the point where you see most pundits they're gonna start calling him one a game Henry, because you know you just see him. He's even against Cuba, he's always good for that one gaffe a game, and it's just really that's probably what's hurt him the most, because that's why he played at West Ham. He's a such a good player, but sometimes at this level, you just don't have the toolbox. And I think today, that first half, him and Vitória, they were just out to lunch together. He was just, like, he couldn't grab control of the game, and I think it was just probably best descriptor of his night, the way he left it, injured. It was just not a good night for the Canadian, but hopefully he can bounce it back soon, because even though he is reportedly leaving the Whitecaps, I think it is good for him to keep playing and keep growing. And I think, obviously, he's getting older, that potential's starting to go away, but I still think if someone can find a coach that can tactically drill him, he could be a mint player.
And finishing off the defense, we have Richie Larea. Your thoughts on him? His brother didn't go drafted in the CanPL draft earlier this week, Reggie Larea, who plays for York University, after a lot of speculation that he might be drafted. But Richie was playing against the U.S. tonight, and you gave him a 5 rank, and why is that?
Well, I love Richie Larea. I've kind of grown to appreciate what he brings to a match, especially these past few months. I think for Toronto FC Canada, he's been one of the best players on the pitch every time. But I think that's why I gave him a 5. Just tonight, he wasn't Richie Larea. The Richie Larea we know, he runs at guys, he's fired up, he's pushing guys, he's tackling, and he was very subdued today. He wasn't bad, but I think he was just symbolic of Canada in the wrong moments. He was just passive, and on some days it wouldn't have hurt, and today it was just symbolic. That's what I'll say. He wasn't a part of the problem, but he wasn't part of the solution.
Do you think it had anything to do with being back in Orlando, playing at the stadium where he found no success as a member of Orlando City?
That probably, maybe, who knows, psychologically that could pay an impact. Maybe it was the heat. Maybe it was just the pain of losing the final for TFC. I think it was probably just a culmination of things. And I think there's no reason to give up on him. I think he is the future at the right back for now, until Zachary Broguiar starts getting minutes at a good club. So I think no reason to give up.
Speaking of right back, Fraser Aird. He was once touted the future of the Canadian right back. The new right back who's going to revitalize the Vancouver Whitecaps attack. I think he just signed in the German third division. It doesn't come to the CanPL. What happened to him? Why did his career fall off the rails? And what's he going to do next?
Less said on that, the better. So Samuel Piet, my next guy in my rankings. He got a 5.5. I think Piet, he was man of the match last game. Same thing, kind of got stuck with, we'll call it, the Larea disease for tonight. Was just unable to impact the game. He had his moments. I think the midfield as a whole was surprisingly solid, but last game they were the difference. Today they just were not able to push the game. So I guess I'll segue into that. The other three midfielders, Marc-Anthony Kay, Scott Arfield, and Jonathan Nazario, all sixes, same idea. They imposed themselves on the game more than Piet. They were more memorable. They were better, crisper in possession. They were physical defensively, but same thing again. Just couldn't impose themselves.
You gave a pretty similar mark to the forwards as well. You put them at a 5.5, Luca Cavallini, John David, and Junior Hoylett. So they were both the midfield and the forwards, they were lackluster. They didn't get a goal. Why the forwards at 5.5? Why are they all the same in the front side of the pitch?
I think just the front side of the pitch, it was probably, as I said in the first half, I put out a hot take on Twitter. I think John Herdman.
You always get those tweets, eh?
Always love those tweets. You can follow my Twitter if you like random thoughts, but that's another story for later in the episode. But I think today, John Herdman, surprisingly, he got the tactical approach right in a sense, but what hurt him is that his line was too aggressive and his defensive organization was, and selection really hurt them. I think the midfielders, they did a good job, considering what they had to do, forwards as well, but they were unable to create chances. Okay. Well, they did create chances, but they were unable to really impose themselves. Okay, in a 1-0 game, a 0-0 game, you get by. When you're getting smacked 3-4-1, it's kind of the game where, same with the Richie Larea. Yeah, on some nights it would have gone by. Today was one of the nights where it didn't, and especially when your defensive line collapses as it did, that's what happened.
You gave two guys standout performances by your rankings. A standout is between a 7 and a 10 ranking, and that went to Canada debutee Stephen Estacchio, as well as Derek Cornelius, who you think should have started the game. You gave him a 7.5 and Estacchio a 7. Why is that? Start off with Estacchio.
I think Estacchio, to be honest, when I saw him coming up, I was like, he hasn't played a first team minute with Cruz Azul since, I think it is February when he injured himself. He's only been playing with the U20s, U23s. It's rumored he's on the go with teams, including the very own Vancouver Whitecaps, linked with the midfielder. So I was like, okay, he hasn't played much at a high level. I'm not expecting much. But what he did, he was dynamic in possession. He didn't look like he was affected by the knee injury. He was pushing the play forward. He was attacking the ball, getting shots, tackling people. He was basically the Steven Eustachio we'd heard of, and even adding a little more juice on the offensive end than I expected. Maybe that he gets a little high ratings based on that surprise factor, because I expected zero given the 3-0 scoreline and his injury, but I was impressed with him. If he keeps playing like that, Samuel Piet, great player, but having that kind of depth at the six, that can go a long way for a team.
And I mean, you also have Russell Tybert, who wasn't here at this game, but he can also play that role pretty well. Back on Eustachio, at 3-0, when he came in, I was thinking, this is just a cap him, eh? Were you thinking the same thing, or did you think that maybe Herdman thinks he can make a real impact on the game?
Well, I saw the sub, and I figured at that point, okay, you're leaving some of your attacking players on the bench. Maybe late in a game like this, you might bring on a Liam Miller to stretch out the game, try to add a little more in the midfield, but with even just get Liam Fraser some more minutes. But you see Eustachio, okay, I think it was a good chance against a good team to see what you had with Eustachio. And at the same, it worked. You see that you have a good piece with him. I think most people had low expectations. They didn't expect him to play. I didn't expect him to play in these windows. His knee was completely gone. So I think it was just good to kind of gauge where your expectations are at with him. And I think now it's fair to see where the hype is coming from and see why he can be a future. Because, yeah, it's great to have Piet. And I think it'll just be good to have all this depth. Like, so imagine next year with Atiba Hutchinson returning as he gains fitness, a midfield depth that includes Hutchinson, Piet, and Eustachio at the six. You got Arfield, Osorio, you got Marc-Anthony Kay, you got Liam Fraser, who's just the only reason that he's held back is that he doesn't play at his club. Even a veteran like Russell Tybert, who fits in. You got David Weatherspoon, who was called in. Like, Canada is deep in the midfield, and I think that's great. And I think as long as they can continue to fix the back line and in a sense use the midfield to help fix the back line like they did against the U.S. in the first game, there's a lot to be happy for.
There were a lot of players missing in this game, including one big name, Atiba Hutchinson. He's on the wrong side of 30. He's on the wrong side of 35, actually. So are you seeing him in Canada's plans for the rest of the Nations League and maybe World Cup qualifying, or do you think he's done with the Canadian men's national team?
Well, I think he's continued because knowing Atiba, he did say he wanted to retire after the Gold Cup, but usually how that thing goes, you set up a retirement. In about 3 days' time, we would have been at BMO Field, probably dressed decently, have a media pass around our necks, and we would be standing there watching him do his testimonial retirement game. But no, he hasn't announced that yet. He's still bucking away at Besiktas. Herdman has been asked several times, understandably so. I heard it in person when I was there over the phone recently. Said same thing. For Atiba, it's fitness. As long as he gets his fitness sorted out, because, hey, like you said, he's 36. Those legs, when you run 10K a game, they don't regenerate the same way. So him, it's getting back to that fitness, especially after the Gold Cup. He got injured. He didn't have a preseason, so now he's just catching up. I think by March, he'll be back in the fold, if not by that June. I think June, he'll be there 100%. March, I'd say about an 80 or 90. But it's too bad that we're not sure if there's Nations League knockouts, because if they are, he's going to be the exact kind of player they need. But it'll be just good to have him in the fold ahead of World Cup qualifying, because we thought the last one was going to be it. I think he's going to want to push for 2022, especially with this talent. It'll be good to have him around.
So if we're to kind of end up this podcast and we're looking forward for the Canadian men's national team, what do we have to look forward to? Is there another match coming soon? What do you think?
For Canada, we must wait and watch other games. There's a good slate of them. Panama was playing Mexico tonight. There's El Salvador still has to play a couple times. You see Curaçao, they lost yesterday. They're out of the rankings pretty much for FIFA. There's a lot of entertaining games going on. So it's basically now, it's going to be scoreboard watching. And when this window's done, it's going to be heck of a lot of calculations, scheduling friendlies. So it looks like Canada, they're going to need to play friendlies. So who knows, we might see a Vancouver, Edmonton, Toronto, Montreal date next year. So it'll be fun just to see, look forward to that. Obviously, it would be nice to be sitting here with a smile, imagining Canada pretty much in the hex. Hey, it's all up for grabs now, but I guess that's the beauty of that format. If there is to be a beauty, there's everything to play for. So we'll see that next year.
Thanks for tuning in to the Between the Sticks podcast. I'm Ben Steiner alongside Alex Gongerutsik. We'll be back probably weekly, and we'll have a lot of our other contributors at Between the Sticks also contributing to this podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.